BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the audio mind space where you, me and top experts come together and inside 28 minutes wrangle a big issue. Today, avian flu has decimated poultry farms and wild bird populations, and now it's spread to mammals such as mink and seals. Are humans next? There's an international epidemic of avian flu, which doesn't sound too worrying if you're not a poultry farmer or a twitcher. But what happens in birds doesn't always stay in birds. There are cases now in mammals such as otters, foxes and mink. And yesterday, the director of the World Health Organization warned that while risk to humans is low, we cannot assume that will remain the case. So what is avian flu? How does it transmit? And what are the dangers of a new global challenge to public health? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the essentials. Joining me in the briefing room is Wendy Barclay, Action Medical Research Chair in Virology at Imperial College London. Wendy Barclay, building block question, what is bird flu?
Well, bird flu is a disease that birds get, and it's caused by an influenza virus. Really a very similar virus to the viruses that cause flu in people. In fact, all human influenza viruses were once viruses in birds, and at some point they crossed over from birds into humans.
Why is it that all flu viruses tend to start in birds?
Well, viruses are what we call obligate intracellular parasites. Okay, so what that means is that they are completely inert outside of a body. They have to get inside a bird or a human, a host, and replicate. Once they're in there, that's fine. But to then propagate themselves, they need to move from one individual in a population to the next. Now, if you think about birds, the very nature of the way they live, they very often live in very large communities. Imagine flocks of birds flying through the sky, or more importantly, birds who have landed on water in large communities. Could be thousands of birds in one colony or flock. And this is an ideal place for a virus to exist because it's not very far to move from one host to the next. The other animals that we now know are really great hosts, of course, for viruses are bats. And if you think about bats hanging in a cave, it's a very similar scenario. So dense populated environments are where viruses hang out.
What example of previous outbreaks do we have where flu has begun in birds and become a major problem?
Bird flu, in terms of a bird issue, has been known since the sort of late 1800s, 1890s. People were starting to notice a disease that they called fowl plague, affecting their chickens and causing all their chickens to die. And we now know, with hindsight, this was a bird flu virus. And such outbreaks in farmed birds like chickens and turkeys have gone on all through the last century, all around the world. People have noticed this happening. But it was much more recently that people managed to put the clues together and realise that some of these viruses were also crossing into humans and causing human pandemics, in fact. And the most famous one of those is the Spanish flu outbreak of 1918, a huge viral pandemic which killed upwards of 50 million people around the world at the end of the First World War.
What actually happens to the bird that's got the flu?
The typical avian influenza viruses don't kill wild birds. They replicate in the gut, they shed out into the lakes, and they propagate through birds, year on year. What's sometimes happens is that these highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses, which make birds very, very sick, we think emerge when the bird flus get into poultry. Sometimes those go back into the wild birds. And once they've undergone that switch, which turns them highly pathogenic, they can also be very dangerous in wild birds. And so then what we start to see are huge wild bird die-offs, because these viruses have changed from the typical avian flus which are out there prolifically in the world, and now they can kill the birds, even the wild birds.
Let's talk about cross-infection now. How does it spread to mammals?
The most likely route of it spreading to wild mammals is when animals like foxes or otters or seals scavenge on dead birds. So you can picture a bird carcass, the bird has only recently died, and a scavenging mammal comes along and eats it. It's now not that it's going to infect the gut, actually, of that mammal, but as that mammal eats it, it will inhale small droplets of the virus, perhaps carried on dust particles or blood or whatever as it's scavenging. And this can infect the mammal's respiratory tract and cause an illness, a severe disease in the animal. And this is what we think may have been happening in more recent times with foxes in the UK, for example. But there are other ways. For example, other mammals which are affected by influenza virus are far animals such as pigs, and pigs can become infected. They're not doing that by scavenging on wild birds. They're probably sharing water with a wild bird. Perhaps a duck has landed on a water source that they're using, or there's some other sort of fecal contamination that the duck may have been in the area of the farm and the pigs have snuffled around.
Now, where humans become infected from bird flu, is that generally as a consequence of mammalian infection or directly from the birds themselves?
It can be either. So, for example, the last pandemic that we experienced of influenza in 2009 is often termed a swine flu pandemic, because we know the most recent precursor virus in an animal source before it crossing to humans were pigs. On the other hand, we don't have any precursor mammal, at the moment at least, for the 1918 Spanish flu. But it is quite possible that people can catch a virus from birds. And in fact, we know that back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, hundreds of people did in fact catch bird flu, highly pathogenic bird flu, from exposure to chickens that they were buying in the wet markets in Asia. And they would buy these live animals and perhaps take them home and kill them themselves and then process the bodies, defeathering, etc. And this can expose a person to aerosols and droplets that are generated during that process, and then the person can become infected.
Wendy Barclay. Now let's look specifically at the current strain of avian flu and find out why it's worrying scientists. Joining me in the briefing room are Dr. Wendy Puryear, a molecular virologist at Tufts University in the United States, Professor Ian Brown, head of virology at the Animal and Plant Health Agency, and Professor Marion Koopmans, head of the Department of Virology at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam. Wendy Barclay has told us generically about bird flu. Wendy Puryear, can you tell us about this particular virus?
So this particular form of influenza is referred to as an H5N1, which also gets often called bird flu as well. And the thing that's different about what we are seeing right now is that it is a specific variant of H5N1 that has been undergoing this evolution for really quite some time now. It initially emerged in 1996. So that was in poultry in Guangdong, China. And it stayed in poultry for a while. And while it was circulating within that region, it did continue to evolve and change and to have these subtle adaptations that occurred until we got to 2005, when it finally made that shift over into waterfowl. So that was the first time that went from poultry to waterfowl. So now it's in wild animals. But even at that point, it was still pretty limited. It wasn't again until another almost 10 years later in 2014 that it started to go in migratory birds and made a rapid dissemination then around the globe. And that quieted, but it continued to circulate still in those wild bird reservoirs. And then coming into late 21, early 2022, it then made the leap across the Atlantic and came into North America. And we have really seen it explode on the scene here in North America since then. And meanwhile, it's continued to evolve and expand throughout the globe as well.
Ian, could you explain the scale of the impact that it's had in the last few years? I mean, what has actually happened as a consequence of it?
Well, obviously, this virus has been spread by wild birds, as we've heard, and then it's found its way into kept birds, you know, domestic poultry, chickens, turkeys, ducks, all sorts of domestic birds. And once the disease is in those populations, most countries will try and control it to limit the spread. Obviously, it has potentially economic impact to the producer of those birds, those commodities for, you know, feeding the population. And then, of course, there's also onward transmission risk. So it's about trying to identify infection early and then control the disease at source. So what we mean by that is eliminate the source of the infection. So conventionally, that is culling infected flocks, putting restrictions on the farm to make sure that the virus can't move off the farm, and then disinfecting those premises before they can return weeks and months later to business as usual.
Marion, this strain of avian flu, is it usually fatal for any bird or mammal that contracts it, or is it usually not?
We do see quite severe disease associated with it, both in birds and in the mammals that we are starting to see with the infection. And that's also where there is a concern from my perspective. I'm working also at the medical side of things, and I'm looking at this global spread to also look at, is there a risk, an increased risk, that this could spill over into humans? And there, what I'm looking at is that we do see quite a number of reports of wild mammals, carnivores, that get infected, including some with severe disease.
That's exactly where I wanted to go next, Wendy Puryear. We've talked about bird-to-mammal transmission. Have we recently seen mammal-to-mammal transmission?
Yeah, so that is a situation that is rapidly evolving. We've seen, actually, even for a couple of years, we started to see a few cases of it going from bird to mammal, but those were all what's referred to as a dead-end spillover event. So it would go in, it would just be in that particular animal or two, and then that was that. Over the last year, we've been seeing it go into more and more wild mammals. We've seen it increasing in the number of species of marine mammals that we're seeing, as well as terrestrial. And then just recently, it was described a mink farm in Spain, where that seems to be the first clear indication of this virus likely spreading from mammal to mammal. And that was a situation where there was an outbreak that occurred in one of the barns on the farm and pretty rapidly went through that whole barn, and just described as a hotspot within that barn. And then it radiated out from there to surrounding barns pretty rapidly. So that seems to be like we're starting to see mammalian transmission. We are also starting to see, there's just recently reports coming out from Peru of sea lions that have been tested positive for this H5N1 strain of the virus. And there have been just shy of 600 animals for sea lions that are being attributed to death from influenza. Only a few of them have been tested and confirmed, but there are three of those animals have been confirmed. So that might be another case.
Ian, Wendy referred there to mink farming, and presumably it's got something to do with the way mink are farmed. We don't actually allow mink farming in this country. Is this why?
Well, we don't, for a variety of reasons. There's cultural reasons why people farm mink. I think just to qualify, in a mink farm, these animals are relatively close contact. The hygiene practices on the farm are probably fairly weak. So what we call biosecurity is quite lacking. So this environment is conducive potentially to transfer a virus between animals. And then, of course, we know it can spread short distances between individual animals. I think coming back to the mammal maintenance question, I think we have to be careful before we jump to conclusions about its ability to transmit between mammals. It's vital that we actually do that monitoring and we gather the science evidence and prove definitively. There have been a lot of mammals infected around the world, but they are, by characteristic, scavenging mammals that often will share habitat with infected and sick and dead birds, and therefore they often scavenge and consume those birds. Those birds are full of virus. They contain very high quantities, and that really can be a trigger to leading to some spillover event. But we do need to be watchful, and we need to actually monitor very carefully by genetically sequencing and determining the genetic code of these viruses so that we can prove beyond reasonable doubt that they are spreading between animals within the same host population.
Marion, I want to talk for a moment about pigs, because it was mentioned earlier in the programme that actually there have been cases of transmission to pigs who tend not to be kept in quite the same way as mink. And whilst it's quite easy to do something like ban the mink industry, it's going to be pretty difficult to place major restrictions on the raising of pigs. Should we be worried about the possibility of transmission of bird flu to pigs and then onwards?
Yes, definitely. And that's because we know from the history of influenza pandemics that that's exactly what may happen. So we know there is the possibility that directly from avian influenza viruses, you can get infections of people. And then with a few adaptations, a few mutations, you may get a virus that actually can transmit between people. But a second option is that an avian influenza virus would make it into a pig, where it then mixes its genes with influenza viruses from pigs. And then you get a reassortant virus that may also be able to infect humans. And that has happened in the past. So that's how I look at particularly the situation, the introduction in the mink farm in Spain. To me, that is a warning sign that we really should be making serious efforts to have this early warning surveillance, both in the fur animal industry and in the pig farming industry.
Ian?
It's absolutely vital we do surveillance in animals like pigs. We've got to remember that they have close contact with humans. They can have contact in some settings around the world with birds, although less likely. We have to also remember that 25 years of this virus or group of viruses have failed to really show clear evidence that pigs are susceptible. That doesn't mean that we can't think that that wouldn't happen in the future. But with this particular strain, latest research out shows that actually pigs, it's very, very difficult, almost impossible to infect pigs with this virus. But it's still vital we're watchful, because we know other flus are quite common in pigs, and we need to make sure that surveillance happens.
Wendy Purrier, can we dig a bit more now into this question of the possible transmission to humans? There's this wonderful phrase, zoonotic potential. Can you explain what that means?
So zoonotic really just refers to the ability for a disease to transmit from other animals into humans. So zoonotic potential refers to the possibility that, in this case, a virus could transmit from another animal species into humans. There are several other examples of this happening. Coronavirus is one that we are all very familiar with recently. SARS, MERS, COVID, West Nile, rabies, salmonella. So this is something that we see in multiple systems, of this potential to go from animals to humans.
Wendy, how pathogenic has this strain of bird flu proved so far to those humans who have contracted it, presumably directly from birds?
So the particular form that is circulating right now, that we've seen the most from poultry and from wild birds in this last year, we have not had many cases globally where it has gone into humans. I think there are fewer than 10 cases that have been described. There has been one fatality that I'm aware of. So it has been a low probability event, as Ian was saying, where we're not seeing that kind of transmission happening, thankfully. And so far, we're not seeing that it is that high level of fatality that has been feared. To put it into the larger context, if you go back 20 years and look at all of the kind of parental strains, the earlier versions of this H5N1, there has historically been a high fatality rate with that, at about 50% or so. We're still looking at around 800 or so people globally over the last 20 years to have ever had any of these forms of influenza. So the numbers are low, but in some cases, fatality could be high if we had those sorts of versions.
Right. OK, so this is a classic example so far of a low transmission but high fatality potential disease.
Exactly.
OK, this is a horrible question, and I can imagine why you might not want to answer it, Marion. But if this did become widespread in humans, would we anticipate a much higher death rate than, say, in COVID? It's a big if, I know.
Yeah, that's a very big if. It would very much depend on in which form this virus would start to become transmissible. Would it be in a reassortant form? And that then may mean that its properties are quite different. But the scenario that I think we have to think through from a preparedness perspective is, what if? What if the high case fatality rates that have been reported for the human infections with H5 predecessor viruses, if those high fatality rates would stay up, that of course would be a dramatic scenario.
And we wouldn't be talking about specific older groups being susceptible, as in the case of COVID. We might be talking about all actually younger groups.
Yes, correctly. With any new pandemic taking off, that's the first question. Who are infected? Who are affected most? What is the risk, underlying risk? What's the age structure of infections? But we do know from previous pandemics that can affect really a major part of the population, depending on if there is some cross-protective immunity from the circulating viruses. Now, with an H5-derived pandemic virus, we would have to assume that there's a potential for very widespread infection and also disease. But it is speculative at this time, also because the data that is there from the rare human cases, you can also wonder how good the testing and the surveillance around those has been, because if you did that very thoroughly, then maybe you would find additional cases that had very mild infections, and then that estimate for the current case fatality rate would go down. So there's a lot of uncertainty there, and I think we should have to be careful about speculation.
Yeah, that last is a very important point. Yeah. Ian, just to be clear, up to this point, humans have not passed this strain on to other humans.
There is not strong evidence. In some of the early cases that Wendy mentioned from Southeast Asia, there was suspicion of transmission within small family clusters. So this would be direct contacts, but it's not well substantiated. So I think essentially, you know, the conclusion is that this virus, whilst it can have severe outcomes in humans, it's not in a form that's adapted such that it's easily able to transmit from one human to another, like the normal seasonal human flu epidemics we see.
Can I just ask this about, in terms of, if you like, the evolution of a virus? Is a virus, and I'm sorry to give it a kind of almost kind of personal element, is a virus looking to transmit to other species? Marion?
It's not, but viruses infect and infected cells start to generate progeny viruses, and that process is not a 100% failure proof. So that's where little mistakes are made, and that's how the progeny may have certain small changes, mutations we call them. And that happens wherever a virus gets opportunity to circulate. And that doesn't necessarily mean it needs to go to other species for that to happen. What does happen is if a virus like that spills over in another species, there may be different selection mechanisms. So one of the steps, the differences between birds and mammals, for instance, is the core body temperature. So what we see is mutations that may give viruses in mammals an advantage in the core temperature that mammals have. So that's a selection process that happens, but it's not something that viruses need to be happily replicating.
Let's talk now about prevention and preparedness. We touched on some elements of this before, but let's begin with vaccines. Can we vaccinate poultry, Ian?
Well, absolutely we can. And in fact, we vaccinate poultry against a range of diseases, including influenza. Some countries around the world have been vaccinating poultry for quite some time now, but it's really important that if you're going to use vaccination, you're really clear what you want from the program. You obviously want to stop birds getting sick. You want to stop them shedding virus and passing it on to their contact birds, and you want to stop it spreading between flocks. And in order to do that, you need a certain amount of rigor in your vaccine. We know from COVID that you need a good match. Your vaccine needs to be well matched to those strains that are out there causing disease. And you have to have the ability to update the vaccine potentially, because as we just heard, these viruses can change over time. And we need to be confident that our vaccine is doing the job. And in a poultry setting, it's very important to have practical things considered, such as how do you actually vaccinate tens of thousands, millions of birds? How can you do that cost effectively? How can you do that what we call efficaciously? You deliver the vaccine to the bird's immune system and it makes a good protection. So there's quite a lot of challenges in having a good vaccine and a good vaccination program.
Which raises the question, you know, about whether or not we could develop a vaccine, should it come to humans for human use. Are we developing one of those?
There is a formal system that through the World Health Organization that twice a year assesses what we call candidate vaccines for H5. So data is gathered from surveillance in animals and people, and effectively they bank strains that show differences. And they're effectively what we call seed viruses for vaccines. So that is at least breaking down part of the process. It's difficult, of course, to know which strain would it be that might cause infection in humans. We'd obviously want the best match we could find. So that's the reason for having a repertoire of different candidate vaccines as seeds that could then be more quickly taken into production should a requirement be there.
And in to your knowledge, is that actually happening now?
Well, that has been happening actually for a number of years now. So from the point when the first cases of H5 were occurring in humans, there was a recognition globally that there need to be a greater level of preparedness because, as we've already heard, some of those outcomes were fatal. So this work has been going on in the background for some number of years now. But it, as I say, it's reviewed twice a year. Because, of course, we know the virus is changing, so we need to be constantly tracking those changes. And if it changes in a way that the host's immune system might not recognize it, then we need to have an alternative vaccine candidate. So this is not making lots of vaccine, but this is just having the preparedness that we've done the groundwork to know that we've got potentially something in our bank. We can go into our freezer and take a vaccine candidate strain out and then use that for production.
Wendy, do you think there are lessons from the COVID pandemic, the way it came upon us and the way it was dealt with, that can help us with this one?
Yes, certainly. And I think one of the good news stories here is that unlike COVID, we see this coming. We are familiar with influenza. We know that this is brewing. So we're not in the position to be caught off guard as much as we were with COVID. So that is an advantageous aspect here. But certainly, as we've learned with COVID, we have definitely learned that we need to respond to things on a global level. So individual countries responding in individual ways is not going to combat these sorts of outbreaks, especially when we're talking about this sort of scenario where it's a virus that is moving in wild animals. You know, wild birds really care nothing about borders. So having individualized responses is not going to combat these things. So working together and doing this very intentional and extensive surveillance to really keep an eye on what kind of variants are emerging and how things are evolving, and keeping those lines of communication open are really critical. And I think what we've all seen unfold with COVID has really driven that home, how important that global response is.
Wendy Perrier there with Ian Brown and Marion Copemans. My thanks to them and to Wendy Barclay. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Cecilia Armstrong. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one on how we mend British railways, the one on whether there are any quick fixes for the NHS, and the one on Britain's energy crisis.
Hello there, I'm Simon Armitage, and I've just walked into my garden shed with a chair in my hand. It's my writing shed, and the chair is for my guests for this series of The Poet Laureate Has Gone to His Shed, including Ian McKellen, Pam Ayres, Loyal Carner and Lucy Beaumont. So pull up a virtual seat next to me and listen in on my chit-chats with the great and good of this world. People who've stopped by for a natter and a cup of tea, but often end up bearing a little bit of their soul or spilling the beans, if you'll allow me several good old-fashioned mixed metaphors for a moment. Listen through the keyhole by searching for The Poet Laureate Has Gone to His Shed on BBC Sounds.